that we have it in our very hands, that we don't have to go through a high priest in order to go into your presence, but we can come to the throne room boldly. And I just ask that as we look at this pivotal lesson today, that you would just show us yourself in a new and fresh way. You would touch our hearts, and that you would just show us how this applies in our own lives today. And we thank you and praise your name. Amen. Okay, we're on 1 Samuel chapter 8. And last week we saw that it took 40 years of Philistine oppression coming in before Israel was finally ready then to cry out to the Lord in repentance. And Samuel, we saw, was the man God had chosen and prepared to lead Israel in their spiritual revival. He called together a general assembly at Mizpah. And you remember it was during their time of sacrifices that the Philistines thought, oh, what a great time. They're all gathered together. They're sacrificing to the Lord. And they came up and attacked. And this was decision time for Israel. What are they going to do? Are they going to trust God? Or are they going to go and take it into their own hands? And we saw Israel then said, Samuel, keep going, keep praying, cry out to the Lord. And he did. And God, of course, sent that thunderstorm totally out of season. And the Philistines were routed. And it's interesting because we were told that after this, they had peace not only with the Philistines, but the Amorites. That was on both borders. The Philistines were on the Mediterranean coast. The Amorites were across the Jordan River. So that gave them peace during the lifetime of Samuel. And what we're going to come to understand the lifetime of Samuel means during his reign or rule as leader of Israel. So then we start today with chapter 8. And time passes. We don't know how long this is, but Samuel now is thinking about retirement. He's had a heavy load judging all of Israel, and so he's ready to pass this on to the next generation. And you saw in your lesson today that as his sons reached maturity, he actually transferred some of the judgeship over to them. They were serving in Beersheba. Now I want you to think about it. When it says poetic, it's from Dan to Beersheba. Dan's far north, Beersheba's the far south. So his sons are in the far south of Israel. Samuel's actually working in the central section. So they are serving as judges. But Samuel tries to formalize the succession of leadership by appointing his sons as judge over all Israel. Did this intrigue you? Did this kind of fascinate you? Samuel, the prophet, the man of God, the one who speaks directly to God, the one that was chosen and appointed by God, would take matters into his own hands and try to pass the succession to his own sons. I thought that was very interesting. What I found even more interesting was when we read that his sons did not walk in the same way Samuel did. Now, they're compared to Eli's sons, but I want you to see the difference. Eli's sons served in what position? Priests. So what they were doing was mishandling the sacrifices before the Lord. They were not acceptable before the Lord. Samuel serves as a judge, so his sons are perverting the legal system. They're accepting bribes. This is a little different, and I want us to note that. But when has ever a judge passed down the judgeship to his son? We just finished Judges. Never. I found this interesting. Well, so did the elders of Israel. It provoked them. They come together in mass, and they come to Samuel at Ramah, and they say, verse 5, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your way. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. Now we notice today that Samuel felt personally rejected. I looked at that, and I think we talked about it in our group. I'm not sure he felt so personally rejected as his sons were rejected. But I think there was a sadness there, and God reassures him. He says, it's not you, Samuel, they're rejecting. It's me. I am the king, and they have rejected me. Now, the subject of a king has come up before, hasn't it? Remember back to the story of Gideon? After he had given a victory over the Midianites, that's in Judges 8:22, the Israelites said to him, rule over us, you, your sons, and your grandsons, because you saved us out of the hands of the Midianites. It was in their mind. And what happens when you start thinking about something? It keeps going over, and eventually it happens. But were you surprised when you look in your lesson today that found out it was all the way back in Genesis? They gave us some references to kings. You see, that was God's plan all along. When you go back into Genesis chapter 49, you see the blessings of Jacob. And when it came to his fourth son, Judah, he said he would rule over all his brothers and that he would become the royal line. So God already had preparing them. There would be a king, but it would be God's timing. So then in Deuteronomy 17, Moses already gave them the law regarding the kings. And he warned them, don't go ahead of God's timing. But we've come to know Israel, haven't we? They're called a stiff-necked people for good reason, aren't they? They want a king, and they want him now. I want you to notice that it's not God's ideal, though. You see, God is working a purpose and a plan. He is going to bring the Messiah through Israel that will bless the whole world. But now they are rejecting God's plan for a human figurehead. They want a man. Somebody that could lead them to a temporary military victory. I want you to think about this. When God was king, they were fairly independent, weren't they? Each family was ruled by the father, or the head. And then the head had a clan. And the clan had tribes. And they were elders. And when was their universal decisions made? Only occasionally. They all were under God's law, but each family was pretty much independent of one another. And here, they're wanting to all come under the rule of one man. Why did they want to come under his rule? Because the neighbors were coming in and they were attacking him and making him slaves. And God says, warn them, Samuel. They're asking for a man that will do the same thing to them. He's going to enslave you. And he went into all the things that he was going to do. He says, you're going to take your prime young man, and he's going to take your women. And he says, if you think anybody's going to be exempt for this, think again. Even all your crops, your herds, no matter what you have, they're going to all go to this king in order to support him, his royal family, and your military. Verse 19, but the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Now, each reason they wanted for a king was really a slap in the face to the Lord. Listen to their reasons. We want to be like other nations. What had God called them? He called them to be unique and special. Well, we want to be like everybody else. And we want a man to govern over us. They wanted a figurehead. God was already their governor. He was already their king. And we want somebody to lead us into battle. Who was leading them into battle now? Who was giving them the victory? God. And they wanted to change that for a man. Nothing Samuel could say could convince them. Verse 22, the Lord answered, listen to them and give them a king. Now Samuel knows they're going to experience tests, but he will obey the Lord and he will give them their king. With the matter concluded, he's agreed to it, they all go home. Chapters 9 and 10 then give us the background of God's chosen king, who is Saul. We're told his father's name is Kish. He's a man of power and wealth. He's from the tribe of Benjamin. And then did you notice 5 genealogies given? 5 generations. Do you remember from last week, what does it mean when the generations are given? He's really important. He's a man of influence. The more generations, the more influential they are. Sometimes you'll only see one, you know, the son of, and sometimes the son of the son. In this case, he's the son of the son of the son of the son of the son. He's very influential. And the son of the 5th generation or the 6th generation is a man named Saul. His name means asked of the Lord. And we also find out that he's quite a young man. He's head and shoulders over everybody else, isn't he? He's very tall, and he's very strong and handsome. All important for a king, right? To prepare Samuel, God speaks to Samuel. The word picture is cute. It's of a turban lifting it up and uncovering his ear. And he said, God whispered in his ear. And he says, tomorrow, a man from Benjamin's going to come. And he's the one I want you to anoint prince over Israel. I want you to notice he doesn't call him king. He calls him a prince because God's king. And he says, and he will not rule. He will deliver Israel. It almost sounds like another judge, doesn't it, with a little step up. I tried to picture myself there. When Saul first meets Samuel, we saw how God brought him. Donkeys. Runaway donkeys. Boy, I bet Saul didn't have a clue what was going to happen that day. Interesting. What do donkeys indicate? Do you remember if you own donkeys? Wealth. Again, that's a sign of wealth. He goes looking for these donkeys. He's gone for 3 days, and finally he says, you know, we better turn around and go back because Dad's going to be more worried about us than these donkeys. And the servant looks around and realizes they're somewhere near Ramah, and he says, you know, I think there's a seer around here. Seer, it's an appropriate term for a prophet. It changes meaning. as we get into Kings, and it becomes the occult seer. But at this point in history, it still refers to God's prophet. But he says he doesn't have anything to give the seer. And then they come up with a quarter shekel or something. And that's enough. And this is interesting because this is the only mention of it. We know that God provided for his priests. The tithes and offerings that were brought provided for their livelihood. But here, apparently God provided for the seers too, that they would bring them gifts. And they have enough, and so they go to Ramah, where Samuel just happened to be there that day. We get into these, just happens again. And Samuel inquires of some ladies that are out there drawing water where the seer's house is, and they said, if you hurry, he'll be coming out the gate. And so they go to the gate, and they talk to the first man they see, and it happens to be Samuel. And they ask where the seer's house is. Now, I want you to notice that's all that Saul asks. He says, can you point me to the seer's house? And Samuel says, I am the seer. And by the way, you're going to join me at a feast today. Then you're going to stay over at my house tonight. I'm going to tell you everything that's on your heart. And the donkeys you're looking for, don't worry about them. They were found 3 days ago. Then he goes on. Look at 9 verse 20. And whom is all the desire of Israel turned, if not to you and your family? This must have blown Saul away. He's looking for donkeys. And all of a sudden he meets the prophet of the Lord who goes through this whole thing and says his whole family's going to be honored. Notice how Saul answers. How can this be? He says, I'm just a Benjaminite. You know, the youngest son of Jacob, the one that was almost wiped out in the Civil War. And he says, in the tribe of Benjamin, I'm the least clan and I'm the least of the least. We've seen this before, haven't we? I think this was Gideon in his comments to the Lord. I'm just the least of the least. I was curious, and the commentary seemed to indicate that this was actually proper etiquette. He wasn't really downplaying, but when you came into the presence of the Lord or a messenger of the Lord or a prophet, you didn't elevate your standing. I don't know how far down he needed to put himself, but you didn't elevate yourself. So this may possibly have been good manners, or it may be simply that Saul was exceedingly shy. Disregards his modesty, and then he says, you are going to go up before me. Up to the high place. This is one of these cultural things. If you think to the Eastern culture or the Near Eastern culture, what does it mean when somebody walks in front of somebody else? It's a sign of honor and respect. We know it more as usually you walk behind somebody, you don't walk in front of them. But who is Samuel? He's the recognized leader of all of Israel. He's the prophet, and he's saying, Saul, I want you to walk in front of me up to the high place. And as they do, they arrive at the banquet where we know there's already 30 men seated. And what has he done? He's ushered to the head of the table. We already know about the first seats. You don't want to go to first seats because if somebody comes more important, you're going to be asked to go and you're going to go to the inn. But here he takes Saul and his servant and he puts them in the first seats. And then he says to the cook, come over. He says, you know that piece of meat I asked you to hold for this special guest? I'd like you to bring it out and serve it to Saul. Do you know what that special meat was? It was the right thigh, the priest's portion. It was Samuel's portion. And here he's giving it to Saul. I can't imagine what Saul was thinking at this point. He'd gone looking for donkeys. He's the honored guest of God's prophet. He's eating the priest's portion. And Samuel acts as if he's expecting him. What a day. Can you imagine? I can't. Well, following the meal, I have a feeling Saul probably had a whole lot of questions. And since they go down to Samuel's home and they go up on the roof. At this time, Israel was very primitive. They had what we would call adobe homes, probably one room. They had flat roofs, and some of them had stairway going up to the roof. And then this is where they catch the evening breeze. And we're going to find as we continue, the women did a lot of work up there. They would dry their grain and stuff like that. And remember back into the law, God said if you had a flat roof, you had to build a wall around it, a parapet, so that children wouldn't fall off and die. God already prepared for them. It was also used as guest quarters. Sometimes they would have a room with a bed up there, and this must have been when Samuel had. So they went up there. It doesn't say what they talked about, only that they talked. And that night, Saul stayed overnight at the prophet's home. The next day, Saul, I think, must have been sleeping in, because if you notice the text, it says Samuel calls up to Saul and tells him to come down. So I don't know if he was trying to take all this in or not. But he asked to speak with him privately. And I found that interesting because, you see, it isn't time to announce that Israel has a king yet. First, he has to make Saul aware that he's God's choice. And I think he also has to give him time to think about this and adjust to the fact that he's a donkey handler and all of a sudden he's king of Israel. Can you imagine? I want you to notice Saul isn't asked, nor is he given a choice. Samuel said, "I have a message from God, and here it is." And he pours out this spiced olive oil on his head. And he kisses him on both cheeks. And he says, "God has chosen you to be leader over his inheritance." Now there's a lot in there. The pouring of the oil is a symbolism of God's Spirit pouring out on God's chosen person. And we already know that he empowers him with his Spirit to carry out a task that God calls him to. So that's the symbol of that. He kisses him on both cheeks, and that's indicating his love and his acceptance of him. And he is going to be leader over his inheritance. His inheritance is both the people and the land. So Saul will be ruler over both the land and the people. And he says, to convince you, Saul, you're going to see three signs on your way home. First off, as you're going and you get close to Rachel's tomb, you're going to find two men coming to you, and they're going to say to you, "The donkeys you're missing have been found, and now your father's worried about you." Sign one. Sign number two, you're going to continue on to the Oak of Tabor. That's where Deborah held court as the prophetess. He says, when you get there, you're going to find three men. And these three men are going to be carrying three goats. I thought, man, that's a buff guy. They're going to have three loaves of bread and a skin of wine. Those would all be sacrificial items that they're bringing into the Lord. And he says, they're going to offer you two loaves of bread and you're to take it. Interesting. If they're taking it up to the Lord, who has the right to eat the sacrificial bread? Only the priests or those that have been anointed and now are set apart and sacred to the Lord. You see, Saul is now authorized by the Lord to partake of sacred things because he has been anointed of the Lord. Finally, he says, when you approach your home at Gibeah, you're going to find a procession of prophets coming down, praising the Lord and prophesying to music. And at that time, the Spirit of the Lord is going to come upon you. He's going to change you into a new person, and you're going to prophesy. Can you imagine what Saul's thinking as he's walking away from his meeting with Samuel? I mean, he just went looking for donkeys. What a day. We find out that all of these signs come through. And he says that he's to fulfill his part when he recognizes that God's doing it and do whatever God shows him to do, whatever his hand is to do. And Lynn put it so beautifully in the group I was today. She said that was an assurance to him that he didn't have to worry about it. God would direct him. He would just do what God directed him to do. He also gives him another little bit of instructions here that really is for us more than it was for Saul. It kind of sets us up for the future. He says, then you go to Gilgal and wait 7 days for me. That's going to be in next week's lesson, but it's a little setup for us. In case you were wondering, like our group was, where does that come in? Well, Saul turned to leave Samuel, and God changed Saul's heart. This is verse 9. And all these signs were fulfilled that day. Saul obeyed Samuel, and he did what God said, and he was changed into a new person. He became headstrong and full of courage, although we don't see it in the beginning, because he's going to need this as a leader of Israel, as the king. The change took place immediately when the procession went by, the prophets, and we find Saul joining them in prophesying. He was near his hometown, and it says that people saw him. In verse 11 of chapter 10 said, a man who lived there said, who is their father, and is Saul too prophesying among them? He knew Saul. He says, wait a minute. This doesn't fit with the Saul I know. Who is his father? There's two interpretations of this that I found in my commentaries. The first one is that we don't know who these prophets' fathers are, but we know who Saul's father is, and he's not a prophet. How come he's prophesying? That's one interpretation. The other one is one of these where it says it one way and it means something else, not who is their father, but is not their father, either the Lord or Samuel. And it's interesting because Scripture, as we go along, and also history documents that Samuel had a school of prophets, or a prophet's guilds, as we might say. And he was training young men. He was teaching them the word, and they were known for piety, praise, and music in their worship. These students had dedicated themselves to the law and to teaching the people the truth of the law. as opposed to the Baals and the Asheroth that was going on all around them. So they were saying, Saul hasn't been a student of Samuel's, has he? Why is he prophesying now? Whatever the interpretation, we don't know, but his uncle comes out and asks a direct question to Saul. You know, what went on there? And did you notice what Saul said? He said, well, I went looking for the donkeys, and by the way, we met up with Samuel. And he says, well, what did Samuel say to you? I know him, he's the prophet. And he says, well, he told us where to find the donkeys, and says nothing about the kingship. I was curious about that, why he didn't say anything. Maybe it was because he hadn't assimilated all this. You know, I'm going to be king. Whoa, wait about this. But maybe Samuel said he was to wait until God's timing, because God was the one that was going to announce this. If Saul had gone out and said, guess what, I'm king, who would have believed him? So I think maybe he was following what Samuel had directed. And there is some time later that Samuel assembles everybody at Mizpah. And he starts out by saying, you rejected the Lord, and now the Lord is going to give you a king. And so they were chosen by lot. And we've talked about this before. The high priest has behind his breastplate a pocket. And in his pocket is the Urim and Thummim. We assume they were probably stones, one light and one dark. And as they would ask questions of the Lord that required a yes or no answer, these would be thrown. They believe in this case, when they were choosing somebody, the elders of the 12 tribes would come by and they would say, is it the tribe of Reuben? And they cast it no. Is it the tribe of Benjamin? Yes. And so they would choose that way. And then they would come by leaders of the clan, leaders of the families, and finally man by man. I was curious about this because it comes down to Saul by process of elimination, but he's not there. And I don't understand how he could be chosen if he's not there. So, and none of the commentaries could answer that. But this obviously was God's directing. So he confirms that Saul is the choice. And when everybody looks around, where is he? Samuel does what we know Samuel does. He goes to the Lord in prayer. And this is another reason we know God didn't talk to Samuel through the casting of the lots, but directly, because he says, I think you'll find him if you go over to the donkeys and look in the baggage. And so they send somebody over there, and there he's hiding in the baggage. I wondered why he was hiding. Scared? I don't think he wanted to be king. He hadn't been asked. He'd just been told. But he's brought out, and as he comes out, here's the man standing head and shoulders, everybody. You can't miss him, right? And what do the people say? Long live the king. I thought that was great. Then Samuel recites the duties and the responsibilities of the king to Saul in the presence of all the people. He's saying, these are God's people. And he's telling him what he can and cannot do. And then it's written down. And then it's placed in the presence of the Lord. Now, we've seen this with Moses. We've seen this with Joshua. Placing in the presence of the Lord means they set it next to the ark. And God serves as a witness between Saul and his people. So that's a very important part of it. Then Samuel dismisses everybody to go home. And as Saul goes home, he notices he has an entourage. Because it said God had touched the hearts of many valiant men. And they go with him. They will actually serve as his bodyguards now to protect their new king and to serve as his army. But there's mixed feelings, aren't there? Not everybody agrees to this good-looking tall guy being their king. There's a few that are not too sure about this. It says they show contempt for the king. Well, chapter 11 shows us the leadership test that confirms Saul as their leader. And I found some very interesting information from Josephus. He's that first century historian that gives us a lot of insight from history. He tells us Nahas, the king of the Ammonites, had been oppressing the Transjordan tribes for quite a while. We talked about this. We said when they went into the Promised Land, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh said, you know, we kind of like it here on this side. We're going to stay here, and God let them have the land. And I said, yeah, but they're going to have trouble because God's plan was across the Jordan. Well, apparently they've been being harassed by the Ammonites for quite a long time because they believe that border belongs to them. Now, it doesn't because God has given them their own inheritance. But I want you to see what's been happening. They have been capturing the men and putting out their right eyes, gouging them. And the reason they were doing this was for warfare. Israel is good archers. You need both eyes to aim. But they're also warriors, hand-to-hand combat, and except if you're from the tribe of Benjamin, you're right-handed. And so to protect yourself, you carry a shield in your left hand, and it covers half your face, your left eye. So if your left eye is covered with a shield and your right eye is gouged out, what kind of a warrior are you? Not very good. And if you transfer to cover your right eye that is already gone, you have to fight with your left hand, and you can't anyway. So this was a strategic military move. But I want you to see what Josephus said. He says, there was not a man of Israel who was across the Jordan that remained whose right eye Nahash, king of the Ammonites, had not gouged out. Did you hear that? There was not a man of Israel across the Jordan that remained whose right eye he had not gouged out, but 7,000 men had escaped and fled to Jabesh-Gilead. The 7,000 were the only 7,000 that still had their right eyes. Now, that puts a little different spin on this story, doesn't it, when we understand the background. We know who the Ammonites were. They're the descendants of Lot through incest with his youngest daughter. The oldest daughters, the Moabites. We saw them last week and the week before. So both of these become problem for Israel. But God uses this to give an opportunity to Saul to prove that he is God's chosen king. The men in Jabesh-Gilead, do you remember the history of Jabesh-Gilead? Remember the tribe of Benjamin? The civil war with Benjamin. Israel came together and they wiped out almost all of the Benjaminites except for 600, and afterwards they felt sad and they wanted to provide wives and they couldn't find any women for them because they'd taken a vow, except there was one town called Jabesh-Gilead that had not rallied when Israel had been called. And so they put to death everybody except the virgins in Jabesh-Gilead. This may play into Saul's history, so that the women there became the wives of the Benjaminites. But here we find Jabesh-Gilead, the men, crying out, and they said, give us 7 days to see if somebody will come to our aid. If not, then we will surrender. And the king of the Ammonites agreed to this. I wondered if he knew the history of Jabesh-Gilead, saying, oh, Israel's not going to come to your aid. I mean, you weren't there for them. They've already wiped you out as a city once before. Why would they come to your aid? But when word gets to Saul, what happens? Look at 11:6. When Saul heard their words, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, and he burned with anger. He took a pair of oxen, cut them into pieces, sent the pieces by messenger throughout Israel, proclaiming, this is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel. Then the terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they turned out as one man. We find another empowering of the Spirit upon the Lord, and we've talked about this. The Holy Spirit comes upon men in order to empower them to carry out a task, and this is God's task. I also wondered if he'd read the story of the judges with cutting up this oxen and sending it around. I was reading the newspaper this morning, and it was really kind of sad. It was talking about one of the fishermen that was helping pull out things from this flight that crashed on, I guess it was Tuesday. Was it yesterday? And a young man was pulling up body parts, and he says, I can't do this anymore. I can't handle this. It was just a tremendous impact upon his life. I have a feeling seeing cut up pieces of something has a tremendous impact. But I want you to notice also what he said. He said, if you do not follow Saul or Samuel. Saul is king, but he hasn't really been united, has he, at this point? Samuel is the known leader. So he's calling on, whether your loyalty is to Saul or whether your loyalty is to Samuel, come. And what do we find? We find that they come as one man. That is a distance of 60 miles from Jabesh-Gilead to Saul. They'd given him only 7 days. This has to be a miracle. I mean, you travel about 20 miles a day, so that's 3 days there, 1 day to gather an army, and 3 days to get back. This is tremendous to begin with. They come. Saul uses a strategy of dividing them into three. And did you notice that they attacked at night? They don't attack at night. They don't have lights. The Ammonites were totally unprepared, weren't they? And God gave Saul the victory. What was the result? Everybody's ready to rally around Saul now. Let's put to death all those people who didn't agree that he should be king. I love Saul's answer. This is the best. He says, no one shall be put to death today, for this day the Lord has rescued us. What a great start for the king. What a tremendous start. Well, now with the nation united, it's a good time to reaffirm the king. So at Mizpah, Samuel had chosen him king, but now he's calling them all to Gilgal, because now he has the support of them. Gilgal's an appropriate place, because when they first set foot on the soil of Israel, Joshua had called them to reaffirm the covenant there at Gilgal. So it's there in front of the Lord that Saul is once again reconfirmed before the Lord. You see, Yahweh would be king, and Saul would serve before the Lord as king and deliverer of Israel. Following the ceremony, they have a fellowship offering, I think, or thanksgiving offering, where they would eat in the presence of the Lord. Now that they've accepted the king, it's time for Samuel to step aside. And like his predecessors, Moses and Joshua, he uses this opportunity to give a final speech. Everybody's gathered together. It's probably the last time he's going to get to address all of Israel. He begins by saying, "I've served as your judge, and I want to give an account of my life. Does anybody have anything against me? Have I defrauded? Have I cheated? Have I taken any bribes of anybody?" And we notice that they answer unanimously, "No." They say his integrity's intact. Then he calls them to account. He says, "I want to remind you once again of your history. God has been faithful. God has been good to you. And yet, when Nahaz comes, you are afraid and you turn. And you turned against your king and you asked for a human king. You didn't trust God. And this is a sin." Samuel says in 12:13, "Look at the king you've chosen, the one you asked for. See, the Lord has set a king over you." And he points out that both of you are going to be under your good behavior now. They must not think because they've been appointed a king now that they're independent of God. He reminds them about blessings and cursings. Oh, we should have this down. Blessings, cursing. You obey, you're blessed. You disobey, you don't. But look what he says in verse 14 of 12. "If you fear the Lord and serve and obey him and do not rebel against him, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord your God, well, good. But if you do not obey the Lord, and if you rebel against his commands, his hand will be against you as it was against your fathers. And both your king and your nation will be destroyed." To demonstrate this, I love this. Samuel prays, and God sends thunder and lightning and a storm. It's a little like if I stood up here in the middle of July in a blue sky and said, "Now God's going to prove my point." And he sends down thunder and lightning, and then it stops. What was the result? They're terrified, absolutely terrified. Last time he did this, he wiped out the Philistines. Now is he going to wipe them out because they had asked for a king? They're afraid, but they're also afraid of Samuel. But they know Samuel, and they trust Samuel, and they say, "Samuel, intercede for us, pray on our behalf." And Samuel does, and he says, "God will not wipe you out." And he reminds them one more time to remain faithful, you and your king. And reminds them one more time, if you disobey, your king and your nation will be destroyed. And then he concludes his speech with reminding them that though he will no longer be their judge, he will remain their prophet. He will faithfully pray for them, and he will faithfully teach them. Wow, what a lesson. I want you to know this is the background for the rest of Samuel, all of Kings, and Chronicles. This is really important because we're taking a change now. We're moving from the judges into the monarchy. But it was not in God's timing. And this is a very good story, and people quite often use this in referring to God's permissive will. I think you've heard that terminology. That's a theological term. It doesn't appear in the Bible. But what this illustrates is that God had a plan for Israel, and it included a king. But the plan was in his timing, in his way. But Israel wanted to be like their neighbors, and they wanted it now. You see, God is already working on the king, but he's a young boy. He's not ready. He's not prepared. But he'll be the man after God's own heart, and he will be ready when God calls him. But the time is not now. But the people insist, and so God allows them to have what they insist. And we're going to see that it creates a lot of heartaches. There's going to be a lot of pain and a lot of trouble that need not have been there if they had been willing to wait for God's timing. And I think when we go through these Old Testament lessons that we can't always take them and pick them and put them into our life, but there's a lot of implication in there. And I think it's a real good time for us to sit down and look at what Israel did. Israel didn't trust God. They had to take matters into their own hands because they were looking at circumstances rather than doing like Samuel and bringing it before the Lord. And they insisted, and they insisted, and God let them have what they wanted. That wasn't his best, but he would let him have it. And I think we do that with God. A lot of times there's things in our life that we really think we want, and we think we want it now, and we're persistent, and God says, okay, you can have it. It's not my best, but I'll let you have it. And I think we suffer a lot of heartaches because we aren't willing to wait. And I would just encourage us, no matter where we are, if we are not in one of those situations right now, I guarantee you will be in a week or a month or a year, because that's life. And I would encourage us to learn from Samuel, to take it before the Lord, and then do the hardest activity in the whole world, wait. And waiting is an activity. It's not idleness. It means persist in prayer and then watch and look all around you and see what God is doing. And then when he reveals to you, then you're ready and prepared to go. Let's pray. Lord, we come before you right now, and we thank you for these lessons that you're teaching us. I pray that we would take them to a heart, that we would see both the blessings and the consequences that result from obedience and disobedience. I pray that we would be women of God, that we would be women who obey you, and that we would receive your blessings. Help us most of all to be Samuels, to turn to you in prayer, and to be known as prayer warriors. We love you, Lord.